Hi, this is Marion Nessel. I'm the Paulette Goddard Professor of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University and a longtime fan of Heritage Radio.
Like Marion, you too can support Heritage Radio Network, a member-based nonprofit radio station operating out of Bushwick, Brooklyn.
I've been on it countless times. I love being interviewed. The interviewers are always really well prepared and fun to talk to about the issues that matter to me the most, about how we can change our food system to one that's healthier for people and the environment. It's just invaluable to have an independent radio station that's dealing with these issues. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful asset.
Support Heritage Radio Network by becoming a member today. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart to donate.
The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew is proudly sponsored by Restaurant Owner App. Restaurant Owner App is a free app designed by a restaurateur for restaurateurs. Visit restaurantownerapp.com for more.
Hey, 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 I'm Jimmy Carboni from Beer Sessions Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew, where we serve a weekly menu of industry commentary based on what the market has to offer. I'm Andrew Friedman from Tokeland.com.
I'm Jimmy Bradley from The Red Cat.
Chef Peter Hoffman ran the legendary restaurant Savoy for just over two decades in New York City's Soho neighborhood starting in 1990. The restaurant was followed by Back 40 and then Back 40 West in the space that housed Savoy. Earlier this week, Peter shuttered Back 40 West and is stepping away from the stoves to write a book and take a sabbatical. And here to discuss this transitional time, and we're thrilled to have you here, is Chef Peter Hoffman. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
You know, it just occurred to me that this little thing we do is our beginning of the show, as I was saying, where we say, where we serve a weekly menu of industry comment, that we could sort of trace this back, this reference,
right,
in some ways to you and what you do.
Indeed. So what's seasonal?
And also joining us in studio is Aaron Fairbanks, executive director of Heritage Radio Network, who spent 2 years cooking for Peter in the mid-aughts. Aaron, thanks for joining us.
Wow,
we're thrilled you could join
here.
Us for this conversation. You know, Peter, at this time, which must be emotional in a lot of ways, although I must say when we met you outside the studio, you seem very happy.
I am.
At peace.
Yep.
Energized.
Yeah. Lots to do.
And, yeah.
You know, you reach a... I mean, there were earlier times, and it was a private time, that I had ambivalent feelings. But once you work through it, this is the right decision for me. And it feels great. And it's liberating. And it's about moving my life forward. And wanting a next chapter, and it's very exciting.
When you say ambivalent feelings, I mean, this is something we were talking last week. We had a conversation at the end of last week's show about the Four Seasons, which is moving technically, but a lot of people see it sort of as definitely an end point in
sure,
a lot of ways. And we had a conversation with Barry Wine about the decision to close the Quilted Giraffe back in the day. And how far back did that ambivalence go? Did you have moments over the years where you would sort of reach a crisis point or a decision point where you'd have to say, I'm in, and then it would pass for a while and come back? Like, how does that work for a chef operator these days in terms of evaluating where you want to be in this business?
I'll answer that second, because the first part really is, I think it's a personal decision that we make on a daily basis, whatever we're doing, of how we want to live and how we're going to commit to the work. And you have to recommit every day, every moment. And so some of the ambivalence is if something didn't go right, and where am I personally responsible for that? And what can I do to change it?
Right. Interesting.
Yeah.
So as you at
interesting
this,
soundtrack.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't feel like they just turned the music on in the restaurant and someone's really feeling there's a little dancing happening.
Well, also, it just made me think of a different. Well, I started to think about it differently upon listening to you. You know, sometimes when we do something for a large portion of our life or a good portion of time, you know, 26 years. It becomes part of your identity,
sure.
You know? And then when you decide about it in one way or another, you know, maybe that hence some of the ambivalence, but
know,
what will I be without this thing that I've been for all this time?
And the identity and the destination,
yeah.
Right? I mean, I've been on that corner.
Yeah, amazing.
Greeting people, being part of the community, you know, some people feel like I'm the mayor of
that's
that
what I was going to say. We got to get you a New York one.
Right. You know, so it I think I'm going to be fine with that.
Absolutely.
You know, but that's a question.
The process,
you know,
right?
It's like there's a whole social interaction and stimulation that I get from being in that space
sure.
of all those relationships. And They'll shift.
Yeah, well, you know, I guess part of this is decision or the thought process, what fills that. But maybe, you know, just being on a new path is enough for now.
Right. You know, I don't know if you ever did it, but I certainly, you know, it's just like you can make a big life change when you're 25 and
right.
sort of give notice and give up, sublet your apartment and go to Europe, right?
Yeah.
I've done that any number of times back then.
Sure.
You can't do that when you're 60 and you've got two kids and you're paying for college.
Got a lot of responsibilities.
You know, and so it's a bigger, slower moving boat, and so you have to take more time to shift it.
Right.
But that same sense of openness, I think, is there for me and can be there to say, I need to remain creative in shaping my life. And
that's kind of how I thought about it. You've been developing things your whole life. So, you know, what's the next thing you want to develop? What's the next recipe? You know, it's the Peter Hoffman recipe. Yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I opened Savoy, I was into the idea of local, but not in the way that we think of it now. It came from being interested in regional cuisines of Europe, and what regional food is what's growing in the place. It's the taste of the place. It's terroir, all those things. And so then I started to understand that was what I was interested in.
Right.
And building those relationships with farmers and growers and producers and things like that. So in many ways, you know, I got deeper into that and that study, that inquiry is what really was stimulating for me all the years. And running a restaurant was just like what I had to do to keep learning. So now it's like, you know what? I don't want to run a restaurant anymore. And I want to keep doing that learning and inquiry.
Good.
I think this would be a nice spot to hear the clip from David, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. David, do you want to run David?
I am very proud to be who I believe was their first hire at Savoy in June of 1990. I had come back to New York after a few years in exile in Philadelphia, going to cooking school and experiencing my first years in the restaurant world. And I returned to New York determined to find that elusive perfect job. And turns out I'm extremely picky. I didn't realize it until I interviewed and turned down dozens of jobs before seeing in the New York Times an advertisement that read something like, two seasoned cooks opening 45-seat downtown restaurant, food with guts and beauty. And it just jumped off the page right at me. And I knew this was it. I instantly knew that this was the place I wanted to work. And I waited a couple days and got a call with the job offer. And I was thrilled. And 10 years I stayed and worked and learned and made wonderful friendships and saw the so-called food with guts and beauty that they promised in the ad and changed my life. I met some of my best friends who I continue to adore, and look to Peter and look to Susan for all sorts of love and humor and support. And I know that this was just such good fortune for me that I happened to be in the right place at the right time. Okay, here's to you, Pete, and here's to you, Susan. Much love, David Wirth. Bye-bye.
Okay, first of all, I have to say for people who can't see us, which is everyone listening, the immediate emotion that came over Peter and Aaron when David started talking was really something to see. That was very special. What's your reaction listening to that,
Well,
Peter?
David Wirth is the chef owner of Crossroads Restaurant in Hillsdale, New York, at the crossroads of Route 22 and Route 23. And you should go see him. He's a wonderful cook and a wonderful, beautiful man. So nice to just go right back to the originating point. And David's right. He was the first hire, and he reminds me from time to time of that ad. Not that I forgot it, but he, I think when I closed Savoy, he made a copy of it, and I have it on my desk. Back in the day, right? It's before Craigslist. You spent $200 to buy four lines. that's how you, right, Jimmy?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so, and Sunday was the only day that mattered.
Oh, yeah. Oh, of course. Right. There was a special rate that Brenda would give you if you took, yeah. Tuesday, Thursday, exactly. Saturday, and Sunday. It's like, no, thanks, Brenda. I'm going to. And how the world changed, right? I mean, it's just like there is no classified with the New York Times anymore, much less nobody buys the paper. But four lines, $200. And so you want to say, how can I make that meaningful? And what am I trying to communicate? And so Guts and Beauty really was the complete distillation of it. And
what does that term mean to you when you say it today?
What it means to me is it goes back to what chef-driven restaurants are about, as opposed to what so much of what's out there in the world today in New York City, which is much more commercially driven, and the thinking is not coming from an internal place, but is a market analysis.
More calculated. Follow the bouncing trend.
And more marketable, what's going to sell versus what your heart wants to do.
Right.
They're very different things.
And it's not to say that I only did what I wanted to do. To survive for 26 years, you have to notice what people are interested in and shift with that. So, of course, we did, But still, it's coming from an internal place of what are you wanting to express? And in that way, it's sort of you are an artist. And I don't mean to put that on a pedestal, but it's just like you're trying to express something, and that's artistic and that's personal, not just responding to the marketplace.
Right. So how about, 26 years on the same street corner in America's, we talk about these revolutions and so on. I don't, know about the start or the end of the American food revolution or what exactly it means right now. But obviously the business has changed quite a lot in the 26 years. You have some stories or tales or anecdotes you want to share on your thoughts on the progression of the business?
By the book, Jimmy. Come on.
Yeah. We got to write the book first.
Right, that's right.
Give us a sample chapter.
In fact, it's just like I was talking about that inquiry, and so that was personal, but it was, it was a Peter Hoffman journey, but it was also the journey for everybody who worked for me. And so that, and sometimes people took it further, right? They were inspired by it and it moved them. And, one of the things I think about is, oh goodness. Rana Welsh, who has a company called Purple Kale, where she does, I think she cooks in your home, she cooks for you, and then you take it into your home and things like that. Wonderful person. Also, she's going to get her book out before me. there are quite a few former employees who have their books out before me.
It's just business, Peter.
Yeah, right.
It's just business.
But I remember Rana coming to, at that time, you know, I was going to the Green Market with the bicycle, and I don't remember how far we had gotten with proteins, but she was doing pastry, and she came to me, and she was showing me the industrial eggs that we were getting from whomever. You know, we buy eggs by the case, and she was like, you know, look at these. These are stupid eggs. You know, they were pale, and they were thin-shelled, and, you know, they were awful. Can we do better than this? And it was sort of like, okay, let's do better than this. Where are we going to, how can we buy eggs and buy them in an affordable way for this restaurant and get it here? And so that was her taking us as a group, as a business, as an entity, a step forward. And so that stuff is great. And, you know, and Aaron, you both did it in the restaurant and then did it in your life.
Well, I feel like when I was really thinking about what were some of the big lessons for me from my time at Savoy, I was like, cooking, running a restaurant, owning a business, it can be about like more than just the act that you're doing. And I remember like you would have writers in to give a talk and build a menu around someone who was writing poetry or different types of prose. And there was really interesting art on the wall, and I would see documentaries later about, and I'd be like, oh wait, I saw that at Savoy. And there was like just this connection that like food and culture were not separate silos, but like all this like gathering in one. And I'm like, I didn't know it could be like that. Mm-hmm. Like that was, it just opened things up so much for me. And it was like incredibly stimulating, like as a cook, to be like, yeah, you need to like think about setting up your mise en place and like working on your technical skills, but you also need to think about what you're doing in the world and like what that means. And you can also take a lot of pleasure by exploring, you know, music and painting and pottery. And like, it was just, I don't know, it's very different than any place I've spent time.
You know, we are technicians and we're not technicians, right? We have to have technique, but we're humans in the world and we're reflecting that back out there. And that was always what I was trying to do. And the dinner series was just a beautiful example of that, and did keep me stimulated to keep going like, yeah, okay, here's this book I read. Here's the customer. I mean, it's just like, you know, Stephen Jay Gould. I mean, when I was in college, I was studying the natural sciences and history as well. So sort of like cooking is a beautiful blend of that. But and so I was into Darwin and evolution and some of that thinking. And one of our good customers was Stephen Jay Gould, who wrote sort of popular evolutionary scientific material. And so one day I said to him, I said, hey, let's do a dinner. Would you be up for doing a dinner? Did you work for me during that time?
I don't know.
No, Andy Feinberg was definitely, I mean, I have a great memory. I'll tell you in a second about it. But so he said, well, what would we do it about? And I forget what I proposed to him. And he said, oh, I don't know anything about that. I'm an invertebrate paleontologist. And so I said, okay, well, we'll do an invertebrate dinner. And so we did an all invertebrate dinner. So it was sea urchins and cuttlefish and a bowl full of as many different bivalves as I could find in the market. And then we had honey dessert, you know, from bees. And it's an incredible dinner. We did it two nights in a row. And but the Andy Feinberg story is that I decided that I was going to, you know, I wanted to serve we were going to do sea urchins, and we cut the sea urchins ourselves, you know, cutting the shell, pulling out the roe. And then I was going to make kind of chawan mushi with uni and ginkgo nuts, you know, sort of ancient tree from that time. And so we had all the shells filled with the custard in a hotel pans, and they started to crack. And so the custard's running into the water, and the water's running into the custard, and there's 50 people downstairs waiting for the next course, and Andy and I are frantically trying to salvage the ones that were good and put some custard from the ones that were good into the ones that were no good, and, you know, sort of wonderful crisis moment, but a great one too.
And I would sit. I'm like, when I worked Garde Manger, and you'd be up in the pastry kitchen upstairs, and you'd get to like be setting up the desserts or setting up some of the hors d'oeuvres, and you're like just kind of like listening to like the talks. Like, you know, I felt, I was like, oh, I'm like get to be here. Or the authors or the people that you brought in for dinners, you'd bring down into the kitchen and be like, hey, these are the cooks. Like, meet them, shake their hands.
Yeah,
like,
you know, it was hard. But I always wanted the cooks to come out into the dining room to hear the talks going on, because we were, and where we could, but sometimes we're basically plating while the talk is being given, sort of, you know, between courses. But I really wanted people to understand what, you know, cooks wanted cooks to understand what are we doing? What's the theme of this dinner? Why are we here? And always trying to give that stimulation back to people.
We've alluded to the book that you've said you're going to work on. How formed is that concept in your head? Can you be able to speak about what that's going to be, even in vague terms?
Yeah, well, I've been writing some things. I've been writing essays that are sort of, you know, it's not exactly a memoir, and it's not just essays about food, but it's sort of like, how does that come together so that the things that I've learned about ingredients, the depth of knowledge that I have about the thing, the food itself, but what are its, how does it play out in either in the marketplace or in our kitchen, so that there's stories and tales that come with that, but it's sort of spanning the whole thing. It's sort of, there's science and then there's life in the restaurant all around a particular ingredient.
Yeah, great. Well, yeah. We all look forward to that.
Yeah.
Can you speak, you know, to people who are listening, maybe who haven't gone through this often painful experience, definitely probably bittersweet for anybody, the sort of the nuts and bolts of what's involved in closing down a restaurant? Like, you've had the last service. Can you just, I mean, not in great detail, but if we could take a minute or two, what are these next couple of weeks like for you? What's happening?
Well... Excuse me. Well, you know, I need to empty the space to turn it over to someone else. I need to capture whatever I can of remaining inventory, although the people who are doing the buying did a really good job of winding it down, but you still have stuff. And you know, I can only eat so much freak. as much as I love it. So, that's yeah. Part of it. And we were starting on Tuesday morning, we started selling things, all the inventory, all the artwork. And, you know, in fact... it's more than just the artwork that was on the wall of Back 40 West. Susan and I have been collecting and thinking about a restaurant, even if it, you know, prior to Savoy even existing, so that there's things that never made it onto the walls that got purchased 26 or 27 years ago.
So it's
sort of like we're taking the opportunity to say, great, you know, it's just like here's a fabulous garage sale. But a lot of it is from all three restaurants.
Is there anything that you or things that you are holding on to for yourself that have particular significance as a keepsake?
Oh, sure.
Can you name one or two of the ones that are most valuable to you from an emotional historical standpoint?
Yeah. Well, and some of them are coveted by customers too, because they know and knew. Well, and they're all historical about the corner of the neighborhood. One is, there's a painting that Alan Hirsch did of Jersey Street, which is a little two-block alley that goes from Crosby over to Mulberry. And that hung on the wall the entire time. And several people's like, you know, are you selling the oil painting with the red brick building? It's like, no, man, you know, it's like keeping that. And then there are a couple of photographs. One was that our landlord took. He was a photographer. And one, it's called Opening Day of the Rodriguez Luncheonette. And so it was, you know, because it was a diner before it was Savoy, and it's a chalkboard, and the guys who took over, Spanish was their first language, and so they didn't know how to spell completely in English. And so it says things like prastini plate, meaning pastrami, and clim soup, clam soup. And I forget how hamburger was written, but hamburger deluxe, as in the deluxe plate. So, and that hung in the bathroom on the second floor for many years, and people knew it and loved it. And, you know, so, no, that's coming home with me.
Great. Yeah. That's great. We're going to go to a break in a minute. And, David, just to give you a heads up, if we could play the Matt clip before break. But before we do that, I just want to acknowledge that Aaron... so we surprised Peter by having Aaron here today.
And then Aaron,
who's running a network here, surprised me and Jimmy by getting these alums clips of the kitchen and having these clips. And so, Aaron, I know you're busy, but we, you know, we've never had a producer. So the job's yours if you want
it. Oh, man. Well, I am so flattered and look forward to working with you on future episodes.
Okay. It's all in jest, of course. Okay, David, if you could play the clip and take us right into the break. And the front burner with Jimmy and Andrew will be right back with Chef Peter Hoffman and our special guest today, also in studio, Aaron Fairbanks.
Hey, Pete, this is your old chef de cuisine. I don't know. I don't even remember when we worked together, but can't think of anybody I'd rather be at the stove with than you. You taught me so much about not just cooking and ways of thinking about food, but really thinking about life and treasuring the first of the season and the last of it, and making everything matter. So at your stoves, I really became more focused than I ever had before, and you continue to shine a light forward for me as I make my way through this world. So thanks so much, Pete. This is Matt Weingarten, and what a wonderful kitchen and community you created. Thanks.
The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew is proudly sponsored by Restaurant Owner App. Restaurant Owner App is a free app designed by a restaurateur for restaurateurs. Restaurant Owner App empowers you to organize your restaurant from the palm of your hand on any iPhone or Android device. Place orders, track orders, and customize supply lists to track the organization of your kitchen or storeroom. Accomplish electronically what you've been doing by hand for years. Restaurant Owner App also allows you to see orders placed by your employees, so you're always in the know. Create a personalized vendor database and review past orders at any time. It also features promotions and specials on goods and services for the hospitality trade. Visit restaurantownerapp.com for more information, or to download for free and start organizing your restaurant today, search for Restaurant Owner App in the Apple App Store or in Google Play for Android phones.
Welcome back to The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew, where we are speaking with Chef Peter Hoffman and also with Aaron Fairbanks, who way back when worked for Peter at his Savoy restaurant.
05 to 07.
Wow. A decade ago now.
I know.
Amazing, right?
Yeah, it's hard to believe.
Peter, you know, you there's this title that you were handed by the Slow Food Association that Jimmy and I just love, the snail blazer.
Right.
But it's also interesting, and I think you'll take this in the right way. I saw an interview that you did with Helen Rosner the other day, and you know, you, I thought, very graciously pointed out that, you know, there were some antecedents sort of to what you did. I think you specifically named Larry Forgione.
Indeed.
Who I think, by virtue of not having a restaurant in the internet age, is largely, to me, tragically, sort of not known to a lot of young foodies and even to chefs. But you know, we were just wondering, who did you sort of see in this aspect of what you did? Who did if we could break it out? Who did you see sort of as your kind of role models or idols? Who did you sort of think of as your sort of like-minded contemporaries? And then who do you really see kind of carrying on this tradition that you're a part of? You know, this very specific aspect of it.
Oh, that was a lot.
Well, let's go with who were people you looked up to?
Were
sort of your North Stars?
Right. So what Larry Forgione was doing was really inspirational at American Place.
In terms of sourcing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I think I said in the article, this is like he was one of the things that I feel was really different about Savoy and our approach was that in New York in particular, because there are places that are not New York that were doing it, but it was just like we stopped being underneath classically French-based, so that regional cuisines really were coming out and coming to fore, and they weren't, it wasn't taking those flavors and mixing them into classical preparations. So that's kind of, and then the sourcing, right? So Larry, an American Place was still had one foot in that kind of French cooking, but it was amazing what he was putting his hands on, and that he was using all this energy to find those people and knew that mattered.
And we should say, for people who don't know, when he was at, American Place, and before that, River Cafe, and even a little bit before that, at a place probably no one remembers called Regine's, Larry was one of the first people, as you said, to be like, why are we using canned mushrooms, you know, when there's farms?
Yeah, let's get morels.
Yeah, and would call all over the United States. And back in the days when he worked for Buzzy O'Keefe at River Cafe, Buzzy, this is pre-FedEx, sent a van to JFK Airport every day to pick up their stuff that came in. I mean, this is what it used to take to, now you can go on a website and click on something and it's there, but this is what it took to, no pun intended, but to forge this world that everybody kind of cooks in today. People have really
they don't have any idea of what
went into this.
And so it's true, and he was creating that, and so that was inspirational.
Yeah.
Another sort of inspirational was a guy, I mean, you can read it. I went and found him, but John McPhee wrote an article in The New Yorker called Brigade de Cuisine.
Oh, Otto.
Yeah,
Otto. Yeah.
So, you know, I read that article. I was working at La Colombe d'Or at the time, French Provençal restaurant, sort of the beginning of me sort of moving the boat away from being interested in Midtown French was to go there. So they didn't go any further afield than French Provençal, but that was the beginnings. So Otto, right? And here's a guy who had a place out in Pennsylvania, and he was foraging in whatever way, that it was going out and collecting or going down the road to where somebody had trout, or coming into New York to go to Zabar's to buy olive oil on Monday on his closed day. And so it was... And he was his own, you know, he was a one-man band, except his wife was the pastry chef. Mm-hmm. And it was like,
And this is someone who consented to be written about only if McPhee committed to not identifying him or the restaurant, or I think he said it was in a so-and-so radius of New York City.
That's right.
And then Mimi Sheridan very famously
went and
outed him.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. But this that was an inspirational thing for you to read.
Totally.
In terms of this sort of
that guy.
Ideal of a certain type of chef.
Writing the menu on a daily basis, writing a menu based on responding to what was at hand on the table or seasonal, that totally floated my boat.
I think you have been that guy for a lot. I was talking with Robert Sterling from Hominy Grill about the fact that you were closing up shop, and he was like, man, I remember seeing him on his bike going to market when I was cooking in the city 20 years ago, and I didn't know that was a thing you could do. And that like totally shaped me and my idea of like how you can source and where you can get things, and like was an inspiration as a like, hey, we're allowed to do this type of a thing. Like mm-hmm. you definitely, I feel like, have been that, you know, there's lots of stories like that.
Yeah. One of, you know, I dined at Savoy years and years ago, and there's a fireplace upstairs, and you know, in the 80s when I was learning, it was like just, you know, the dark room in the back with the cooks. You know, you can never speak to them. They're just, you know, half of them are drunk and the other half are misfits. And, you know, then in California, the open kitchens. But I saw something at Savoy where, you know, you have a fireplace, right? So you're like, conventional wisdom would probably put it, you know, a two-top in front of the fireplace and sell the most romantic table in the house. And instead, I saw you cooking in it. And cooks come out of the kitchen, walk through the dining room with a, you know, duck. An hour later, they walk the other way with a cooked duck.
Right.
And I was like, no, now that is like, that's breaking down all the walls. But it's also, you know, just like, it was like your house. You know, like you could just feel it. You were like, listen, if that matters, you're not going to want to be here anyway. You know, if that matters in a negative way, if that mm-hmm. matters in a positive way, this is what we do. And this is how we do it. And I was like, holy fuck. Like, yeah. That is so cool. Just yeah. blew me away.
Yeah. It had its inefficiencies.
Of course, right?
That's part of the charm.
Upstairs, downstairs.
That's part of the charm, isn't it? Isn't that part of the charm? I mean, even it for was. You, wasn't that kind of a badge? It had to be a badge of honor.
Well, I don't know.
In a way.
It was... I was doing what I wanted to do. I wanted to use the fireplace. I wanted to build the menu around it. It was just like I had to, but I stopped because it wasn't efficient. And I mean, I remember at a certain point, it was just the prefix menu on the second floor, and it was a separate chef and a separate menu, and then downstairs was a la carte, and it was slow in the summer, one summer, and the accountant said to me, it's like, so if somebody wants to come in downstairs and eat a la carte upstairs, do you let them do that? And I go, no, because the orders and the tickets and the this and the that. And he goes, you're an idiot, man. You know, you got to stop doing that. You got to take every customer that you can get. And it was sort of like that. It was like the wake-up call in one wake-up call was to say, yeah, you can't, the concept is great, but if it's not working, you got to change it and go get what you need. So yeah. It's like, yeah, okay. So then I talked to the cooks. It's like, what does it mean to be open upstairs and downstairs and a la carte and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, people have their resistance, but I remember, I think it was Nicole Wester was the chef in the downstairs kitchen. And I said, okay, this is what we have to do. We have to serve a la carte on both floors. And we'll adapt the menu to that. And she was like, okay, I'm down with that. We'll figure that out. So, you know, you have people who are positive. I'm switching the topic a little bit, but you have people, chefs or employees who are positive and want to problem solve, and people who are door slammers.
Gripers.
And gripers, yeah. And it can't work. And so, you know, the ones you remember and the ones that you cherish are the ones who said, yeah, we'll let's go. We'll figure it out.
Yeah. What about, in terms of, the you know, I started with this long question, but what about kind of when you were ramping up at Savoy and really getting rolling, were there kind of like-minded peers that you, people who you saw as kind of soulmates and contemporaries that you would sort of talk about what you were trying to do and how you were trying to do it? Or did you consider yourself really more of a kind of a lone wolf in those early years?
Laura Restaurant was an interesting one, sort of short-lived, but she was, you know, she came out of the West Coast and I can't remember her provenance completely, but was associated with Alice Waters mm-hmm. in some ways. And so, you know, Chez Panisse was certainly a very important and remains an important lodestone for all of that,
yep.
You know, sourcing. I mean, that book, when the first Chez Panisse book came out, Susan and I were both working at Hubert's and the, you know, talking about the farms, naming the farms in the book, or all of that was really important to us.
Yeah. How do you feel these days when you hear the term, you know, farm to table, which is sort of kicked around as a relatively new thing. And even people who really, in my experience, who weren't really, you know, like, put aside someone like Larry Forgione, let's say, but so many people who once the, you know, once the light was kind of shown on, oh, we should be getting seasonal things, we should be getting, which sounds really weird now as I'm saying it, it's such a given now, but there were a whole generation of, generations of cooks who sort of started trying to do that long before that term came into vogue.
Sure.
What's your feeling about that term and the sort of understanding out there that this is sort of a current thing?
Well, you know, I suppose it's a mixed bag in some ways, but for the most part, I mean, I think it's great. I think it's great that people are caring about that on the surface, what it looks like is that people are caring about provenance of their ingredients.
Yep.
Some backstory, how was it produced? What does it mean? Under that, hoping that it's about better taste or maybe even better production methods, better for the planet maybe, but the taste matters, that not all carrots are the same just because they're orange and they're,
right,
you know, tapered and cylindrical. you know,
we're really sexing up the carrot.
Yeah. So I think that's great. You know, in some ways it's gotten watered down, and so that if you say what I do is farm to table, they just nod their head, and people may have an understanding of it, which is good, because I used to have to go through a whole long explanation of, like, you know, what kind of restaurant do you have? And it's like, well, you want to say, like, I've got an Italian restaurant. Oh, okay, great. I know what that is.
Yes.
And then there were years where I had to explain it and how we buy and, you know, all of that. Now they understand it, but it's not any, there's nothing distinctive about it.
Right.
And then, of course, there's people who say that they're doing it and they're not really doing it. But
sure.
That's not important. I mean, yeah. You know, I don't want to belabor that part, because that's the unimportant part.
And the minority.
It is. Yeah. I mean, it's just like the fact that there are, you know, lots of chefs that you can find at Union Square every day that the market is there is fabulous.
Yeah.
And they take it back to their restaurants and they cook it. And the thousands and thousands of people that are supporting farmers markets by going and shopping wherever they are, not just Union Square, but, you know, throughout the city and throughout the country, that's fabulous.
Yeah.
You know, because there's so, you know, the commodified food isn't good for any of us.
Right.
And the more we buy direct from people who are growing for taste and growing for it's better for everybody.
I love the way you describe those early interactions with people and having to explain. You know, anyone who does something new, I think, there is this period of time where every transaction is almost like a, for lack of a better term, it's almost like a sales pitch or an education.
Sure.
Even at the table often, correct? I mean,
yeah.
To bring the customers along into this new place.
What's a diver scallop? You know,
or even like Nobu. You know, you ask the guests at Nobu, and they'd say it's a sushi joint. You ask Nobu, and he would say it's a Peruvian restaurant.
Right.
You know?
Let's before we get to the last little bit of the show, David, can we run please the one remaining clip that Aaron went and foraged for us?
Yes.
Hey, Peter. I'm really excited to see what you do next, and I congratulations on many years of successfully running a restaurant, and just wanted to let you know that I will always cherish every lesson I've learned from you forever, restaurant-wise, life-wise, etc., and I'm really happy for you. This is Shauna Pacifico, and I worked for Peter for about 10 years.
Wow.
I want to just share like one other point that I think is for me was like really salient about my education at Savoy. I remember we had sockeye salmon on the menu one July, and I was very confused by that, because I'm like, I'm working at a restaurant that's known as for like local food, and I went to Peter and I was like, I don't understand why we're serving this salmon, because it's from Alaska. And, you know, you kind of turned to me and said, like, there are special things that exist in the world that we as diners and humans want to take part of, and we have access to, and we get to support. And yes, we like have a focus on like local cuisine here, but there's all this other great stuff. And I would just like, I don't know, maybe love to hear you talk a little bit more about why it's important to celebrate and feature those special things, and why the conversation about food is more than just local and farmers market, sure. which is something you're so known for, but you did all these other really special, like spotlighting things of great stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, for starters, it's like, I feel that I got pegged by the press as Mr. Local, or that wasn't what I said I was doing, or that wasn't what I was doing, right? I mean, so that if I was buying salmon from Alaska, and that was my value choice, and I'll explain that in a moment. But so, yeah, that didn't fit with being Mr. Local. But I never said I'm doing the 200-mile diet. You know, I never tried to do that. What, you know, one of the things that we all have become aware of, and I became aware of, was that, like, I heard the term food miles, and so you go, well, what? That does matter, and energy consumption matters, and so where do you apply that? It's like, we were always buying coffee and chocolate and lemons and vanilla and, you know, all these ingredients that you couldn't possibly, in New York, you couldn't possibly have without, I mean, as a local ingredient. So we're involved in global trade. I can celebrate the fact that we're in global trade. And then you go, okay, well, that doesn't mean that I'm going to fly in my raspberries from South America in January just because I can have them. So those decisions about what do I want to express on the plate, if I want to express seasonality, then I'm going to say, great, you know, raspberries aren't there anymore. And like Matt said, you say goodbye to certain ingredients, and they're gone. So if they grow in our region, I want to serve them when they're in season. That's sort of what was one of my principles. Another, though, was who's doing it right? And what are products that really celebrate great taste and great communities of food producers? So, what, you know, it's like, I don't know what the years are, but it's just like, I didn't know that farmed salmon was a problem until 1997 or 1996, something like that. So I was buying farmed salmon in 1992, 1995. You know, so that information slowly came out, and you go, oh, and I'm, you know, it was just like Becky Goldberg from Environmental Defense Fund sort of introduced me to that. And it's just like, this is really messed up, really messed up. And so I said, great, I'm not serving that anymore. Well, what alternatives are there? And then sort of started to find out that, in fact, that there's 5 different wonderful species of salmon in Alaska. And here's sockeye that there was no fresh market for it. It always went into can, and it's fabulous fish, and it's cheaper than king salmon. And we started serving it. It was just like, here's a wonderful product that we can just be proud of and celebrate and learn about that culture, that economy, and support it with our dollars. And so, yeah, I'm going to expend, if everybody has a little wallet full of food miles, I'm using mine on sockeye salmon.
Yeah, or you know, maybe abalone. You
right.
know, West Coast. Sand abs. Right. Can't get sand abs around here, but when right. you have them, you're like, oh, I want more of these in my life. Yeah. And you don't always have the time to, you know, take a week and go somewhere to eat the food that you want to eat, so I think bringing things in, little special things, you know, for a reason.
Sure.
You know, that's very cool.
We sadly have to wrap up, but
no.
You know, I know it always flies. Peter, you know, I was, and I don't want to embarrass you, but you know, with each of these clips, each one is, you know, as much as the other, watching this emotion that came over you listening to it. I was sitting here like, what's straight? And it almost seems parental.
Those relationships are parental.
When I sit here watching your reaction, it's a reaction I've seen from proud, like a proud parent.
Sure.
Is that accurate? Is that how you feel toward these people? Who we've been playing clips from?
But they're also peers at the same time.
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, it's just like I mentored these people.
Yeah.
And you know, mentoring isn't just teaching them how to cook or whatever. I mean, like Shauna said, it's just like teaching life lessons. I think Matt referred to it as well. It's just like, it's You know, my most intimate relationships in the restaurant were with the chef. And so that was always a working, how do I get them to cook, be honest to themselves, but be cooking the food that I want. It's not like, here's the recipe, go cook it, and don't, you know, talk to me about it.
Right.
You know? So I'm trying to shape cooks and shape approaches. And Shauna, you know, for in a certain way was so thirsty to be shaped in many ways and let it happen. And so we had a great relationship talking about the food, and it wasn't always a tug of war of like, well, I want to do it my way. And you know, there was no ego on the table in that part of the interaction as there sometimes was with other chefs. It's like, well, I'm doing what I want to do and, you know, put something on the menu and I have to go, okay, that's not really Savoy, or that's not really Back 40 West. And so so that was always a great thing that she and I were able to do together, and she ran with it, you know.
It's great.
So
we really want to thank you for being here. We know it's a big week for you. We were just honored that you, I know people throw that word around. We don't throw it around here, I don't think, ever.
I would say that you took the call, let alone came out.
Can we have a round of applause for Peter Hoffman?
Thank you so much.
It's really great to have you here.
It's so much better than what I mean, I knew we would have a good time because I like talking to you guys. But the clips and that kind of arc of the time span was really, really, really special to me. And
great.
Thank you for that.
Great. It was great to have this almost hour with you. Aaron Fairbanks, thank you for joining us. Thank you for those clips. That was great.
Super stuff.
Thank you, as always, to our engineer, David. And you can... Oh, I'm sorry. Thanks to our sponsor. I'm overwhelmed with emotion. I almost didn't thank our sponsor. Restaurant Owner App. Please visit their site and check out their app. And you can follow us on Twitter at Chef Podcast. We're also on Facebook, The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew. And with that, I'm Andrew Friedman.
I'm Jimmy Bradley.
And we will see you back next week on The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.